Hi, my name's Annie Warburton. I'm the Creative Director at the Crafts Council. I'm here at GCPH to talk about the relationship between craft and well-being. Before I launch into things, I'd like to know a little bit about you and who's in the audience. So we've got health, we've got art, we've got education, community, yeah, okay. Who's a maker? Quite a few of you, fantastic. Who used to be a maker and is still now? Okay, just a couple, okay. So that was a really interesting and generous introduction, thank you. I think what we're witnessing at the moment in terms of the relationship between making and community is something of a revolution. And it's in part, and perhaps ironically, a digital revolution, because the means of production are changing, they're radicalising, they're getting into the hands of all of us. And just as digital technology has transformed the music industry and the film industry and publishing and the way we consume our news, the way we make content and the way we receive it, that's now happening in the physical world. So just as we've had open source coding, we've now got open source making. And I hope towards the end of this, what I hope will become a conversation, we might touch back on that. That's not at the very heart of my talk, but as you mentioned it, I thought I'd just draw that in. So watch out for that theme as we go. When I started in my current job as Creative Director at the Crafts Council, I was asked to give a presentation a couple of months in, and this was the topic. So I went back to my job description, and I just checked whether saving the world was listed there, or superpowers were in the person's specification. No, they weren't. But increasingly, it feels like this is a challenge that's being, for good and ill, being laid at the feet of craft and making. This challenge to save the world, or at least save part of our worlds. And this is coming up socially, politically, economically, and personally, I would dare to say, soulfully. So if we think about politically, we see a lot of what's called craftivism. It's what I think is a rather ungainly portmanteau world of craft and activism. Perhaps a really interesting recent example of that was the popularity of the pussy hats during the women's marches following Trump's assumption of the presidency of the United States. What was really heartening about this was that many people who couldn't march, for many reasons, were making pussy hats for those who were marching. So this is a very simple piece of craft activating in the political sphere. Craft has always had quite a contested relationship with luxury. You might recognise this image. It's called "We Sit Starving Amongst Our Gold." It's by Jeremy Deller, and as you can see, you've got William Morris looking fantastically bearded, rising like Poseidon from the Venice Lagoon. And what he's throwing out from the lagoon is Roman Abramovich's yacht that had parked itself in the lagoon and blocked the view of everyone. So what Della was saying was that, you know, like a once and future king, maybe Morris will come back sometime to save us from luxury. And yet craft is also supportive of the luxury industry. This is obviously Grayson Perry introducing the first London Craft Week. We're about to have the third next week. And what's really interesting is that London Craft Week, as an entity, focuses mainly on craft in relation to luxury, luxury handbags, shoes, jewellery and so on. So it's quite a narrow conception of what craft is. So on the one hand we've got, I can see nods in the audience, on the one hand we've got craft saving us from luxury, and on the other hand we've got it supporting it. You can see it. These are actually Crafts Council exhibitions showcasing craft in Dubai and in Basel and in London. Exceptional pieces of work, but very exclusive. So there's these contradictions right at the heart of craft. This is the Poseidon again. This is William Morris saying, "The greatest foe to art is luxury." He, as we all know, was a revolutionary, a socialist, a campaigner. And yet, at the end of his life, he bemoaned the fact that he had to serve what he called the swinish luxury of the rich. And one of the contradictions in Morris's own production was that many of the people who worked with and for him couldn't afford the works that they were making. So this, in a way, is all quite well rehearsed. But so craft might save us politically, it might save us economically. I've got a better image. The esteemed craft writer Tanya Harrod pointed this out. This isn't my perception, but I think it's rather wonderful. Is that this very exquisitely gold-tooled volume belongs to Morris. You probably can't read its title right there in the middle, but it's Karl Marx's, in French, Le Capital. And to me, or to Tanya, who pointed it out, and I agree, she said that this object is like the materialization of this contradiction between the socialism of Morris and of craft, what's claimed for craft. And then the luxury that often appropriates the handmade for its own devices. So then we've got, can craft save us from the digital world? I started off talking about this a little. So these are all makers who've worked on Crafts Council schemes or been part of Crafts Council schemes and been supported in getting going with their practice. But as you can see, the images are quite traditional, they're quite what we might expect about craft. So is craft all about the handmade? Well, no, because lots of it is made digitally. And I'll just debunk that arts and crafts myth that they weren't against the machine, but they were against the taking over of by industrial production of agency from the maker. So we don't reject the machine, but we want to see it mastered. We're for human mastery, said the arts and crafts. So nowadays we see a lot of digital production combining with the handmade. So in the top right there, you've got Michael Eden's brilliantly named Wedgwoodent Chirine that's made using additive manufacturing. But Michael Eden is based in Cumbria. He was a very traditional ceramist, producing beautiful tableware for over 20 years. And what Michael says is that he can only use the new technology in this way because of that learned knowledge in his hand. He's just using another tool, he says. Because it will take too much time, I won't go into those other works, but as you can see, the digital is influencing every material. John Masterson in metal, Jeff Mann in the candlestick, the Beat Woven, which is a wonderful combination of digitized music and fabric and pattern, and then a piece that Gareth Neal made for the late Zaha Hadid. All are combining traditional craft techniques with the digital. So let's not get too romantic about craft being only about the hand and only about the past. It's as much about the future, and certainly for the Crafts Council, that cutting edge is where we position ourselves, that we're there on the leading edge of craft, or we hope to be. So then we've got a number of writers seizing on craft as the making of the person, of character, of autonomy, of agency, of being human. And this is quite interesting because it's also has a political as well as a sociological aspect. But it is grasped from people across the political spectrum. So we've seen this revolution with the Maker movement. Richard Sennett, who I'll come back to, wrote a very influential book around 10 years ago, The Craftsman, which was all about this seizing of character. I can see nods in the audience there as well, it's familiar. So one of these things is, can craft save our soul? Can it save us politically? Can it save us economically? Can it save us from the digital, bring us back to the physical? Or can it save our soul? And I think the most interesting example here is this book. This is the same book in its UK and US editions. So you've got the UK edition on the right. It's by an American author, Matthew B. Crawford. It's called The Case for Working with Your Hands, Why Office Work is Bad for Us, Fixing Things Feels Good. But there's this kind of quasi-metaphysical, mystical, soulful aspect, shop class as soul craft. So craft is being claimed for us spiritually as well. So can craft save the world? Well, that's up for debate. But what I want to focus on today is the relationship between craft and human well-being. So if you give me a pause for a moment. So for Ruskin, he's this our second bearded Victorian of the day, and the last actually. Ruskin spoke of the three qualities of craft being the combination of head, heart, and hand. So it's about the combination of our intellect, our emotions, our soulfulness, if you like, but also our embodiedness in the material world. And I would argue that it's these three qualities that are conducive to well-being in its broadest sense. And by this, I don't mean simple physical health. I don't mean simple physical and mental health. But I mean the sense of what Aristotle called eudaimonia, the sense of what is a well-lived life, what is a purposeful, meaningful, flourishing life. Now, earlier today, I had the great privilege and honour to visit Galgale, the social enterprise, building boats, working with people recovering from mental health and addiction, and transforming lives. I can see, again, nods in the audience. He's visited Galgale and knows about it. Almost everyone, I don't need to tell you. When I was there earlier, I felt, actually, being here, I don't need to give this talk. Just let's all go back to Galgale, because that's showing what I'm going to talk about, as I hope will be revealed as I carry on. So, I'm going to skip, sorry, I'm just seeing where I am. I was going to talk about what do we mean by craft, but I think we've talked a bit about that already. So what I'll go on to is picking up on this, what do we mean by well-being, and think about this, which is back in the late 60s, Bobby Kennedy pointed out that GDP, which is how we traditionally measure progress in an economy, doesn't really capture what life is about. And that was way before we then had the Easterlin paradox, where he tracked health and well-being against income. I know a lot of you all know about this work, so I won't delve into that too much. But he found that they weren't, beyond a certain point of income, they weren't correlated. They didn't grow together. So it was telling us something about measuring how successful we are in terms of money, in terms of GDP, is really unsatisfactory for a whole bunch of reasons. And then this kicked off More recently, in the last 10 years, as again I expect many of you know, with the movement to measure subjective well-being. Nicolas Sarkozy commissioned a monumental report on how do we conceptualize subjective well-being in terms of life satisfaction, in terms of pleasure and hedonism, but also in terms of this more elusive eudaimonic flourishing, the sense of flourishing. He commissioned it from three big shot economists, Amartya Sen, Stiglitz, and Fitoussi. And very shortly after that, the OECD, the UN, the European Union, and eventually you'll remember David Cameron and the coalition government, all either adopted resolutions of putting in a broader conception of well-being at the heart of how we measure progress and success in a society, and or started to measure them. We had the National Happiness Project. Those measures are, or those statistics are still being gathered through the National Household Survey, and we're still measuring and tracking well-being. But what's more nebulous is how does that apply to policy? Because, of course, those statistics can be used to design policy, and they can also be used to monitor the effectiveness of policy. But at the moment, we're not taking them from the number into actually what does that mean for what we do, how we design our programmes, how we live. And in addition to this, this idea of flourishing is, because it's the hardest to grasp, the most meaningful but the hardest to grasp, is the one that at the moment is defying measurement. We have quite well honed measures of subjective well-being in terms of positive or negative affect. We also have very good statistics and measures, accurate, valid measures of life satisfaction. But there are also a lot of contradictions inherent in that, because you know, if you're a cruel person and you commit an act of cruelty, then that enhances your life satisfaction, and therefore the index will rise. That's a sort of a very simplistic way of explaining that it's an unsatisfactory measure. But this idea of what makes a life worth living, what does it mean to be human? How do we inject meaning and purpose into our lives? What creates that? Well, we're not so good at using that in policy or measuring that, but I would argue that craft tells us a lot about it. So, that's a scary table. Don't worry, I'm going to go in depth into it. But when I was researching this, and I'll come into the practical, I'll move away from this kind of theory back into practical in a moment, you might be relieved. I looked at different conceptions of eudaimonic well-being, and particularly about Amartya Sen's capability theory, but also self-determination theory, and then I compared it with some of the conceptions of what is a 21st century skill. So we've got on the right, and this is on the left. This has influenced a lot of policymakers. We've got the conception of 21st century skills. That it's yes about knowledge, yes about skills, and those skills are about creativity, communication, collaboration, and critical thinking, the so-called four C's. But they're also about much softer things like adaptability, persistence, resilience, integrity, justice, empathy, and ethics. And as you'll see, there's a lot of claims being made through social enterprises in craft that they develop these capabilities. When you go back to the right of this chart and you see self-determination theory, it's picking up some of those themes, but much more simply, with autonomy, relatedness, and competence. And for Amartya Sen, in his capability conception of flourishing, what was most important for him was a sense of, or is a sense of, autonomy and of freedom. The capability to exercise one's own values and those own valued capabilities. And his colleague, Martha Nussbaum, who's there on the right, and again, I'm not going to read out the whole list. What I think is interesting is that she started with autonomy, freedom, self-determination that Sen had, and then she added in playfulness and imagination. And in all of these lists of what makes a life well lived, she was one of the only people who brought in this artistic, cultural aspect. So bear all of that in mind as I go into some of the more practical stuff. So if we think about those conceptions of what a larger idea of well-being might be, then we think back to arts and crafts and Morris talking about the importance of dignified, creative occupation and the need for a connection with life through work. And we can start to see that there's a trail, there's a story here. And that's a story that many social enterprises are starting to tell and voice more and more. So we have here on the top right, Kukula, which is a social enterprise in Berlin, working with predominantly Syrian refugees, making furniture. We've got the Workspace Project near Cape Town in South Africa, which I'll come onto in a bit more detail in a moment. On the left there, we've got Assemble's Granby Workshop, the products from that project, which was in Granby 4 Street in Liverpool, worked with the community to start to make products through the reclamation of these very, very run-down and derelict homes, and then sell those. And as we know, that went on to win the Turner Prize as a social enterprise. So that's Granby Workshop in action. The first Liverpool edition was supported by the Crafts Council at an exhibition called Build Your Own, which was about open source making. And then, of course, it went on to show in the Turner Prize, as you will know more than anyone in this city. Then we've got these new communities of making. So I talked right at the beginning about how digital is revolutioning what we make, who makes it, where we make it, how we make it. And there are networks of so-called fab labs, makerspaces, this network, which I think is particularly interesting, called the Maker Library Network, that again, and this is slightly coincidentally, not entirely, kicked off in the UK and South Africa with the support of the British Council. And what's interesting about the Maker Library Network is, as you can see, and as its name implies, it's not only a makerspace, and it's not only using new technology. It's what I would say is a full spectrum approach to making, using the highest technology and the most basic skills and everything in between. The libraries spring up everywhere. They're hosted and curated by a librarian. So they're not just a space, they're a space for knowledge exchange. They're not just a room full of machines and tools. They're about peer-to-peer exchange of skills. And they also have displays. And the one at the bottom, by the way, is the Edinburgh Maker Library, which is mobile. So I promised that I would talk a little bit more in detail about Workspace in South Africa. And I want to talk about this because I can find where I am. Because in how it describes itself, it picks up many of those themes we heard about earlier in the conceptions of what does flourishing mean? What is it to live a meaningful life? And Gal Gael, incidentally, uses the same kind of thing as well. So in Workspace, they have a program called 10, The Employable Nation. And it's a 25-day course, and it's designed to stimulate young people's interest in making. So they learn making skills, they make 10 products, but they also learn qualities or characteristics, we might say. There are of course 10 of them, so I'll just go through them. Service and love, dedication, reliability, trust, teamwork, vision, respect, communication, understanding, and a work ethic. Now, you know, again, I could have added that list into my other list of lists, because there's a lot of crossover in this. But what they're saying is that making is special. It matters, literally, because it's using matter. Making is special in building those skills. I don't have time to go through each of those 10 to explain how, but obviously go to their website if you're interested. But just to give one example, they talk about trust, learning trust through welding. So you learn a skill, how to weld something, but in learning that skill, you're also learning to trust other objects, cars and vehicles that have been welded, right? You're understanding how something's been made, you're understanding the trust that's invested in you in making something, and the trust that you invest in someone else. So it starts to connect, coming back to those introductory remarks, community and others with making, with the physical world and with yourself. And as I said, with Gal Gael, which I loved, there's a very similar ethos about building skills for life as well as practical skills for employability. And maybe towards the end we can start to think about that in relation to vocational training policy and what that means, because what we're seeing in these spaces is a much bigger story than just the instrumentalism of I'm learning this skill in order to get that job. So, thinking about all of that, both the theory that I spoke about earlier, but also these claims, I got curious about, well, what is the evidence for all of this? Is there any? And I rummaged around, I did tons and tons of literature reviews, I delved into the sort of back streets of the grey literature, and there was very little, very little. One of the things that was most remarkable is that in any research on training that's qualitative rather than any research actually, but qualitative was what I was particularly looking at, no one speaks to the learner. They speak to policymakers. They speak to employers. They speak to skills providers. But no one had spoken to the learner about their experience. What are they getting out of it? So this kind of piqued my curiosity. And so I went ahead and did a project where in two settings, one was apprentices going through a very formal apprenticeship in the Goldsmiths Company, I'll describe that in a moment, and the other was in a social enterprise, rather like Gal Gael, but on a much smaller scale, making furniture in High Wycombe with young people referred through the police and through social services, bless you. I went and interviewed trainees and apprentices in those settings to find out what was their story, what were you getting out of it? Aside from, yeah, of course the skills for being employed, but you know, what else were you getting out of it? It was very revealing. This is Travis. who at the time worked at Out of the Dark, we were trained and then became a manager actually at Out of the Dark, restoring furniture. I was telling a story earlier this afternoon, which is one that I love, about his view of people changed through this work. So Travis went to work with a local man to learn how to cane chairs as part of his informal apprenticeship. So he would visit this guy in his shed every week until he'd refined the skill. It was several weeks in before he found out, and bear in mind, you know, Travis was referred by the law. It was several weeks before Travis found out that this guy was a retired copper. Okay? So he was saying, I couldn't believe it, we got on so well, and I would never, ever have talked to this guy. So it transformed how he saw himself, you know, because he was like, he would never talk to me either. But it also transformed how he saw relationships. So, what did I learn? Well, again, I won't go into this in deep detail, but I looked at what the conditions of those two training settings were that fostered a sense of flourishing. I've just talked a little bit about community, I'll come back to that. But also the balance of course, challenge and competition and support, variety and an opportunity for autonomy and agency. And it developed, that's the conditions of the context. They developed particular skills or capabilities, and those were constitutive of flourishing right now. They gave immediate satisfaction in making stuff, but they also gave those skills and capabilities for future flourishing. So we're doing two things at once. It wasn't just about the hedonic, it was about a longer life trajectory where these skills might take you. That all sounds a bit abstract. We're talking about craft, so let me give you some concrete examples. So we know about Mihai concept of flow. Evan, these are all, code names. Evan, of course, didn't know about that, but he talked about it really eloquently. He said, well, you know, I practiced and practiced and practiced, and then one day it just clicked. Everything fell into place, and that was a great feeling. And I think what's interesting is he talked about his skill turning from something external to him to being internal to him. It's sort of part of me, really. So we've got flow. We've got the enjoyment of the process of transforming a raw material or an old object into something new, into something useful, into something valuable that creates meaning for you as a maker and for the person for whom you make it. You know, all of these processes, the little things you've been doing, added more value to it. You've taken someone's rubbish, you've put your own touch on it, and let's not forget the importance of touch. We're talking about physical skills, with the sense of touch. And you've changed it. So these are fulfillment in the process. But there was also, of course, fulfillment in outcome. You've accomplished something. You've taken two things, you've transformed it, and as Oscar says here, all these names, by the way, were the jazz musicians when I did the coding. I thought, how am I going to do it? So that's where they come from. But he says, you know, it's not like office work. And this came up a lot when I was talking to these young people. These are people, the youngest was 15, the oldest was 24. They were mainly young men, which reflects the sector, at this part of the sector, two young women. But Oscar said, you know, it's not like doing office work that my friends are doing or service work. You've actually got something. You've got a product. So again, that satisfaction that makes a life meaningful. And then I think this surprised me. I wasn't I didn't know what I expected because I was going in openly in the research. But I don't think I expected this, and it came up again and again, that these apprentices, what they were getting out of it was making something for someone else. So this, as you can see, was someone working the goldsmiths company. They made a ring, and in making that ring, they took exceptional care because they knew that, all being well, that ring would stay on the person's finger for the rest of their lives. So it was really special. It was meaningful work. Again, this is an 18, 19-year-old contrasting what he's doing and what he's learning with his friends. So, again, what makes life fulfilling? And then what are you learning through it? First of all, this self-discipline. When you submit yourself to working with a material, you're working with its resistances, its affordances. You discover what you can and can't do, and that challenges you as a person. It's not utterly malleable. Then you're also learning the discipline of taking care of quality. Quality came up a lot in my interviews, the appreciation of quality among these young people. So Yusuf is saying, yeah, you know, when I started off, I messed around a bit. And then slowly, gradually, I learned that it's really good to care. It's important to care. And then sort of related, I think, to the discipline of a skill and of making is perseverance. This kind of thing came out through many of my interviews. This relationship that was, you know, as far as I can tell, as hopefully a self-aware researcher, wasn't prompted by me, but came through the listening of the apprentices describing that journey from what they were learning about the making, I'm always going to make it a bit better, and then translating that into their lives, I'm going to make myself a bit better. So it's a sense of resilience. And then this sense of curiosity, that a problem isn't a problem. A problem is something to be delved into, to be tackled, to be explored, to be curious about, and then hopefully to resolve. And if you don't resolve it today, then you'll go back to it tomorrow. This sense of perseverance that's learnt through working with the materials. And community, which we talked about at the beginning, was really important. The Goldsmiths Company, all except one, who was the young woman, had come through into the apprenticeship because they had a male relative in the trade. So it all came quite literally through family. At Out of the Dark, there was equally a sense of family, but a curated community sense of family, and the word family was used in a lot of those interviews. But there was also the sense of, well, I can't mess up, because if I mess up, I'm letting someone else down, that this team, this community, my community is important, and I need to step up to the mark because I owe it to the people around me. So the relationships with the masters in the goldsmith setting, those apprentices are very traditionally, literally bound to their masters. And then in this much more informal setting, in both ways, this relationship between the teacher and the student was key, and then the community of other apprentices around them. The ability to respond in different ways, to be flexible, and that flexibility aspect of resilience was another thing that came up again and again. Oh, I can use that material in a slightly different way. Oh, if I try that, oh no, maybe that doesn't work, but I'll try in another way. Came up in almost all of the interviews that I did. And again, that translating that understanding from material into a learning for life. So as you can see, a lot of those theoretical metaphors that we touched on at the beginning were actually coming out in my interviews with all of these young people. And the understanding, David Pye talked about the workmanship of risk. And to me, this is related to trial and error. The workmanship of risk is what you have in craft, that you're always working with the unpredictability of your particular material, the way the grain is on that particular piece of wood. And you have to respond to it and work around it. And he contrasted that to the workmanship of certainty, which was machine production that's always the same. And we could say that the workmanship of risk is something that gives craft production its aura, its specialness, its soulfulness, if you like. But it's also, when we're coming back to what does it mean to live a flourishing life, it engenders the capability of resilience and flexibility to respond in new ways, to try things out, and it's okay to fail. Almost everyone I interviewed said, oh, I learned it's okay to fail. There's, you know, my master, he still makes mistakes. He tells me he's still learning. Okay, it's all very zen. And so if we go from, we've talked about how is craft fulfilling in the moment, what in process and in outcome. Then we've talked about what capabilities does craft develop. And the last aspect is how does craft facilitate future flourishing. So what came through in these interviews, that by rising to the challenges of the setting, of the community, of getting along with people, and the challenges of the material and making, they also developed aspiration. So Hugh is from the Goldsmiths Company. They really do push you, push yourself, go for it, do things well. Scott from Out of the Dark, they want us to expand, learn, go different places, understand different things. Now, these two young people were taking different paths. In the Goldsmiths Company, you're being apprenticed to follow a career right up until you retire within a particular trade, whether you're a stone setter or silver engraver. Whereas Out of the Dark, you were learning furniture restoration, furniture making, perhaps to pursue that, but more likely to pursue something else. And the aspirations of the seven young people in Out of the Dark were mainly to go into completely different careers, everything from IT to social work. But they were very clear about what skills and qualities they were learning through making that they would take on into the future. And then I think this is the last one on the interviews. Is that these experiences and the variety of the experiences, whether they were making something for someone else, or being commissioned, or having a new challenge, or working with different materials, gave them a sense of, oh, okay, I've got flexibility, I can do anything in a way. I've built these skills, and it is opening up pathways for me. So again, craft is building the capabilities for future fulfillment as well as current fulfillment. And then the last part is this sense of you're in control. Grayson Perry, who we saw at the beginning, said, craft is the physical manifestation of I can change the world. Okay. So I make something and I can see that I've made a physical difference in the world. And that's really, it's very simple and it's very profound. And it's a sense of agency and empowerment in life. And to me, that's also related to autonomy, that actually, if I know how to fix things or how to change things in life, then I can be reliant on community, but I'm not dependent on community. I can also have autonomy. So I popped these three slides in. I don't know how we're doing for time. Okay, I will wrap up then. There's a whole other aspect of craft and health and well-being that this we could have had a whole different conversation. We're not going to have it now, but things like new forms of making are transforming prosthetics, especially for young people. We're seeing more and more, and this is an area of work that the Crafts Council is working in, particularly collaborations between makers and medics, not as art residencies, but as innovation collaborations, research and development. On the top left, you've got Matt Duran, who is a glassmaker who worked on the world's first tissue-engineered tracheotomy. He facilitated that. At the bottom, we've got a project of soft robotics working with a paper maker. And here we've got Karina Thompson, who's an embroiderer, working with a soft roboticist, looking at picking up muscle signals through movement, both for health and for sport. I just wanted to touch on this because I focus very much on this particular sense of well-being, but I wanted to mention that there's a whole other realm of craft and health, and if that piques your interest, we can talk about it. Similarly, the Fixpert project, which is a project that partners a designer, a Fixpert, with a Fix partner. We don't have time to go into that right now either, but it's a movement and a project that is really transforming how we think about addressing problems. It's bringing people together with different expertise in partnership to solve problems. On the bottom right is their new schools project, but the top and the bottom left is a project between, and I can't remember anyone's surnames, the Fixpert is called Maya. She's based at Benchmark in Dorset, and she's working with Heidi, who has cerebral palsy, and they're co-designing utensils so that Heidi can cook, and these adapted oars that are made iteratively until the design's exactly spot on, so Heidi can go rowing, canoeing. And I would really commend those films to you. You can go watch them online. They tell a fantastic story about collaboration through making, how making brings people together. So our future's in the making, I would say. Our current and future flourishing. We in Scotland and England are facing a bit of a craft education crisis. So whilst we've got this community flourishing of peer exchange of learning, informal education, craft courses are closing. In England, over the last 7 years, 50% of courses have closed in higher education. And the number of students taking GCSE in art and design and design and technology, slip of the tongue there, has also declined by nearly 50%. So on the one hand, we've got this story of the value of making, and on the other hand, we've got policymakers who aren't recognising that, you know, that making, just as much as music and art, which are also being relatively neglected, but not quite so much, is really core to being human. And on that point, I'd note that the original reading, writing and arithmetic wasn't that. It was reading, wroughting, as in making, and arithmetic. So literacy, making, and creativity, and then numeracy. So that's in the 19th century, that was the original, which sort of got distorted. So this is a manifesto for craft education. You can, it's something that the Crafts Council produced and we wrote, but in partnership with people right across the country. And we launched it in the House of Commons, which is there. But we also snuck in a screen and did screen printing so that we got the politicians rolling up their sleeves and actually making in the House of Commons. So I'll come back to my bearded Victorian. When he wrote News from Nowhere, he said that he was concerned with the question of how we live and how we might live. With what does it mean to live a meaningful life? What does it mean? What is fulfillment? What is human flourishing? And he talked about the book as being the embodiment of dreams in one form or another. So the embodiment, so being physical, taking something from the ether, the dream, bringing it into the body, into the physicality. And I think this is, I hope, a very deliberate use of language. So into form, into an object, into practicality. So from the abstract into the concrete. So the future is in our future is in the making. It's in our hands. Thank you.